So I was a lesbian and gay rights activist for a long time before going into Parliament. If I've been able to achieve anything, it's been to try and illustrate, just by being me, that gay and lesbian people exist and that they're pretty normal and that their lives are pretty ordinary, but that they have issues and that their issues are valid.
I'm not saying that this is the best book in the world and this was the best thing in the world, but for those who love Bewitched, I wanted to make it a happy read. I wanted the people to read the book to be as happy as they were watching the show.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Chrétien lays Canada's contentious same-gender marriage proposal on Parliament, Australia's first openly gay senator outlines his agenda, and rerunning classic TV magic through a queer lens. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 10th, 2002. In the wake of a landmark Ontario Superior Court ruling requiring equal marriage rights for gay and lesbian couples, Canada's Prime Minister Jean Chrétien has referred the issue to a parliamentary committee. Justice Minister Martin Cauchon, who is appealing the court's decision, will present a discussion paper to the committee next month. Public comment and hearings will follow, and Cauchon hopes the committee will reach a conclusion quickly. The Ontario court suspended its ruling for 2 years to give the government time to comply. While Chrétien staunchly refuses to reveal his personal position on same-gender marriage, three members of his Liberal Party cabinet this week told reporters they support it. Industry Minister Alan Rock, Foreign Minister Bill Graham, and Heritage Minister Sheila Copps. The national group EGAL, Equality for Gays and Lesbians Everywhere, expects support from at least four other cabinet members. However, the cabinet was unable to reach a consensus this week in its first meeting since the court ruling.
Chrétien also appointed a new justice this week to the Supreme Court of Canada, where it seems inevitable the marriage question will eventually be considered. Marie Deschamps has served a decade on the Quebec Court of Appeal, where in 1999 she supported spousal pension benefits for gay and lesbian partners in Canada's first favorable ruling on that issue. She's expected to continue the strong civil rights positions of the justice she's replacing, Claire Leroux-Dubé.
A recent survey of 1,200 Canadians commissioned by the ruling Liberal Party found 48% in support of equal marriage rights and 43% opposed. That led pollster Michael Marzolini to declare, "The writing is on the wall for this issue. It will become more popular. It will become more acceptable. Government can lead public opinion or it can follow it. And this is an opportunity to lead it rather than follow it."
Another survey has found even stronger support for gay and lesbian marriage in Hong Kong. Hong Kong Polytechnic University questioned more than 500 people by phone and found that 80% supported not only same-gender marriage, but full adoption rights for those couples. Respondents were somewhat less enthusiastic about personal contact, however, with 70% declaring they would have no problem with open gays and lesbians as friends, classmates, or colleagues, and only a slim majority willing to accept them in positions of authority.
Scotland's Law Commission this week called for a legal reclassification of gay and lesbian domestic partners as immediate family to give survivors status to sue when their partners die. The Law Commission had taken up the issue at the behest of the Scottish Executive and concluded that the deceased's immediate family should consist of those relatives who are likely to have had a close tie of love or affection with the deceased in the context of contemporary family structure.
But recognition of gay and lesbian partnerships remains problematic for most religious groups. The Roman Catholic Church in Germany has indicated it will fire any of its employees who contract Germany's new legal registered life partnerships. Germany's top Catholic, Cardinal Karl Lehmann, has vocally opposed the partnerships law enacted last year, and the German Bishops' Conference appears to have concluded that partnerships are incompatible with church employment. The Diocese of Limburg has gone on record with a letter to church groups made public this week saying, "Since entering a registered life partnership is considered a serious violation of loyalty obligations, dismissal is in principle justified and can only be disregarded in special cases."
And hopes for advances for gays and lesbians in the Anglican Church when Dr. Rowan Williams takes over as Archbishop of Canterbury were dashed this week. Despite his history of support for non-celibate gay and lesbian priests, it was made public this week that Williams has sent a letter to the world's 38 Anglican primates, which affirms anti-gay resolutions adopted in 1998 by the decennial Lambeth Conference of all the world's Anglican bishops. At that conference, more than 80% of bishops rejected homosexual acts as sinful and rejected both blessings of same-gender couples and ordination of non-celibate gays and lesbians. Williams wrote that that Lambeth resolution declares clearly what is in the mind of the overwhelming majority in the communion and what the communion will or will not approve or authorize. In what was clearly a response to a Vancouver area diocese's June decision to bless gay and lesbian couples, Williams added that, "I accept that any individual diocese or even province that officially overturns this resolution poses a substantial problem for the sacramental unity of the communion." The first public response came from Britain's Gay and Lesbian Humanist Association, whose leader called the letter a shocking betrayal.
The one gay positive item that emerged from the conservative-dominated 1998 Lambeth Conference was a resolution for further study of the issues. But after 3 years of discussion, an international panel of Anglican bishops has failed to find common ground. The panel was appointed by conservative outgoing Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey, led by gay-friendly U.S. Anglican leader Bishop Frank Griswold, and included Dr. Williams. It announced last week that it has failed to reach agreement on what it called a single pattern of holy living for gays and lesbians, on how to interpret certain Bible texts some believe condemn homosexuality, or how to handle the relationships among biblical authority, tradition, reason, and experience. On the one hand, the panel called for still more discussion as to whether homosexual acts and committed relationships could be compatible with Christian holiness. On the other hand, it called the heated division on gay issues a burden and distraction for the church.
Meanwhile, gay and lesbian pride celebrations continue around the world. This week's included Amsterdam's unique water parade, where despite pouring rain, more than 75 decorated barges sailed down the Prinsengracht Canal before tens of thousands of applauding spectators. A large number of countries were represented by boats sporting their national flags, including one bearing both Israelis and Palestinians. UK-based international watchdog Amnesty International participated as well, affirming that gay rights are human rights.
Stockholm's Pride Parade this week drew some 50,000 spectators to watch 6,000 to 12,000 participants. Gay police officers in uniform created a stir, as a former national police commissioner declared in a radio interview that it's illegal for off-duty police to wear uniforms. Current management seems to have a different point of view, though, as a statement from headquarters said the force should reflect the whole population.
Other recent Pride events included a parade in the Swiss town of Neuchâtel, where about 4,000 people marched before some 30,000 spectators. Marriage and adoption rights were among marchers' leading demands.
In the UK, the city of Hull celebrated Pride for the first time at the end of July, with 200 people marching through the town and 500 turning out for a rally. But despite strong corporate sponsorship, Bournemouth canceled plans for a week-long Mardi Gras to have culminated in a parade this week, with organizers blaming community apathy and the city council's refusal to stop traffic for a street party.
Canadian gays and lesbians have been celebrating Pride from coast to coast. This week's march in Vancouver featured 150 entries and a total of perhaps 120,000 observers and participants. But its sole grand marshal was represented only by a picture and a wreath. Aaron Webster, victim of a notorious fatal gay bashing in a city park in November that organizers called the single most galvanizing event in our community this year. Also in British Columbia, a month earlier, thousands of people turned out to watch Pride in Victoria, the provincial capital.
Also this week, Montreal's Diversité Parade drew a crowd of some 750,000. The march set off with the announcement that construction is about to begin on a new gay and lesbian community center, with governments contributing about half the projected $7.5 million Canadian dollar cost.
Last month, Pride in Ottawa, the national capital, saw a turnout of 55,000 to 60,000, a jump of 60% higher than last year's. Also in Ontario last month, more than 2,000 people marched for Pride in the town of London.
And in the East last month, more than 2,000 people cheered on Pride marchers in Halifax, Nova Scotia, while about 300 people marched in the second Pride parade of the Prince Edward Island capital, Charlottetown. In St. John's, Newfoundland, only 80 marchers were willing to brave the bitter cold. As the local newspaper The Telegram noted, there were no feathers or fishnets to be seen.
Among a number of U.S. Pride events of the last month, probably the largest was in San Diego, California, where more than 100,000 people turned out to watch 215 entries in the 28th annual parade.
But there will be no gay and lesbian carnival parade in New Orleans' Mardi Gras, as the mayor and city council agreed this week that their budget couldn't handle a 35th parade for the 2003 schedule. The gay-inclusive crew of La Cage aux Folles had already invested $50,000 in planning a 19-float procession they believed would generate income far in excess of any cost to the city. And crew captain Chad Williams charges that the city's budget argument is just a smokescreen for anti-gay discrimination. That's despite his declarations that their parade would be not a gay pride Southern decadence parade, but a Disney-style G-rated production.
And finally, comic book fans who once had to content themselves with reading between the lines of ambiguously gay duos like Batman and Robin can now find a full-on gay wedding. Superheroes Apollo and the Midnighter avow themselves husband and husband in the latest issue of DC Comics' The Authority, and even adopt a child together. Alas, it's the final edition of the series.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 10th, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
You may remember trying to twitch your nose, but were you aware of the underlying magical message of that beloved 60s sitcom? Get ready to be bewitched forever later in the program. It's been 3 years since Brian Gregg became the first openly gay senator ever elected in Australia. A member of the minority Australian Democratic Party, Gregg had already established an impressive track record as a prominent activist in his home state of West Australia. But as he tells our John Frame during a recent visit to Brisbane, Queensland, his experience in Parliament has called for a somewhat different kind of political work.
You've been a senator for 2 years now?
As of June 30th. I will have done 3 years, which is halfway through my Senate term.
And it is comfortable for you there?
Well, Parliament is not a very welcoming place to anybody. There are 76 senators and, you know, most of them are out to get you. But there are opportunities for progressive members of Parliament, Democrats in particular, to continue to try and prosecute a Democrat's agenda. And that includes GLBTI issues, and we're the only party to have a specific spokesperson on those, and that's me. And, you know, I happen to be openly gay, but I think perhaps that the strength behind me, which allows me to do that stuff and to do it with some kind of mandate, is the fact that I was a lesbian and gay rights activist for a long time before going into Parliament.
Many people find when they come out as gay in their workplace, and that's a matter of whether they're working perhaps in a hotel or, you know, God knows where, and they'll then have people feeling comfortable then about coming up and asking them about what it's like to be gay. Do you find yourself educating a lot of the other senators?
Well, no senator has ever asked me up front about gay issues. And I don't know that they would, but I guess I find if I've been able to achieve anything, it's been to try and illustrate, just by being me, that gay and lesbian people exist and that they're pretty normal and that their lives are pretty ordinary, but that they have issues and that their issues are valid. Issues around money and property and relationships, which affect all people, are different for us as it is from heterosexual community. But for the most part, they're blissfully ignorant of that. And it's just a question of slowly educating them. And I think to some small degree I've been able to do that, to the point where when we Democrats now move amendments on same-sex couple issues, we may not have the political support for it, but we have some level of understanding for it. And my hope is that that bodes well for the future.
And of course, when you're looking at ensuring that rights for couples come into being, you are in a position too where you have a same-sex partner, so they directly affect you.
Well, they do, but I have to be very careful politically that my advocacy isn't seen as self-serving, and my opponents, or homophobes in general, would, if they had the opportunity, use that against me. There was an example, for example, an illustration from last year where we dealt with an issue in the Parliament relating to parliamentary salaries and parliamentary entitlements. And I and my party argued for same-sex partnership recognition in superannuation parliamentary schemes. The argument used against that by both the government and Labor to defeat that was that that would be special rights because no other section of the community which works for the Commonwealth has superannuation rights. So they argued against it for pollies on the grounds that because it didn't extend to anybody else in the community. Well, of course, the obvious comeback is it should extend to everybody else in the community. When are we looking, when are we going to deal with that piece of legislation? Well, of course, neither of the major parties are keen to advance or embrace that.
I like the way you were saying tonight when I suggested, should people become involved with a political party that has the aspirations they're looking for in lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intergender issues? Or, you know, is it valid to have then lobby groups, specific lobby groups? You are suggesting there is value in having a lobby group as well as the parties.
I don't think it's just a question of value. I think it's essential. You must have a two-pronged approach to law reform. You must have a grassroots lobby group advocacy campaign and service, but you also need user-friendly pollies because ultimately what you're talking about is legislative reform. That means Parliament and it means politicians. But the grassroots swell of support and advocacy and education has got to start outside the Parliament. And it's a question of the community bringing the Parliament into line with it and not vice versa.
Now that you've been an out and proud gay man as a senator as well, do you see that you're getting a good response then from the Australian public?
Can I answer that with what I find is a really sweet story? When I gave my inaugural speech on the 1st of September 1999, it was a speech which, for the most part, just talked about homophobia and lesbian and gay issues. And it was personal, and I was pleased to get it on the record because it's nothing if not my message. Within a day of giving that speech, I got an email from a young guy who was 14 years old who had seen a little bit of my speech on West Australian TV News, and he sent me an email to say that he was moved by it, he was proud of it, that he was gay, but he was 14 and he was just struggling with coming to terms with coming out. 3 years down the track, that person played a key role in being an out gay young man in the West Australian law reform campaign. And he spoke at rallies as a 16-year-old, speaking on behalf of age of consent issues, completely out of the closet and with a very supportive mother. And I find that wonderful.
That's great. Senator Brian Gregg, it's lovely to have you here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was openly gay Australian Senator Brian Gregg in conversation with This Way Out correspondent John Frame.
Hi, this is Ron Romanofsky.
And this is Paul Phillips.
And we're Romanofsky and Phillips.
You're listening to This Way Out,
the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
And if we weren't on the radio right now, I'm sure we would be listening.
Herbie J. Pilato spent several years doing the research for Bewitched Forever, the immortal companion to television's most magical supernatural situation comedy. But it was a labor of love. His goal was not simply to chronicle the on- and off-screen details of the popular 60s show. Pilato was not alone in his belief that the classic TV sitcom was in many ways a metaphor for queer life. Pilato's quest led him to meetings with gay civil rights advocate Elizabeth Samantha Montgomery and several of the show's other stars. But it took some 1990s magic to make it happen, as he explains in this enchanting discussion with Joan Devlin.
You got to meet many of the cast members in the early 90s prior to their deaths. And I wanted to ask you, how hard was it to get to talk to all these people, Elizabeth Montgomery, Dick York, Dick Sargent,
Well, it was very hard because really nobody would speak with me unless Elizabeth would. And she finally agreed to that after 6 months of me calling every 2 weeks. One day I was working at some club in L.A. as a waiter. And the tips were bad one night, real bad. And I came home and turned on my machine where the light was flashing. And all of a sudden, hi, it's Lizzie Montgomery. Call me back. So I finally convinced her to do this. And she really saw that I was not just trying to do some stupid little book about some, you know, show that I thought was silly. I knew that that Bewitched was a respectable program about, and there were so many other things going on, that it was a stronger work ethic, that it was about prejudice, that, you know, that it was about this person who really loved this other person for who he was and not what he could do for her, you know, because whatever he could do for her, she could zap up something better. This was about true love, and it was done so well, like a half-hour movie. So anyway, she finally talked with me, and I said, well, geez, do you think you can talk to Dick Sargent and David White? Because they won't talk to me unless you talk to me. So finally, I get this call one day from Dick Sargent, and he goes, hi, Herbie, this is Dick Sargent. I just got a call from Elizabeth Montgomery, who I haven't heard from in 20 years, and I guess I'm supposed to talk to you. And as I'm on the phone with him, I hear, beep, 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 call waiting. Hi, Herbie, it's Lizzie. Did Dick call you? I'm like, oh, my God, I'm on the phone with Samantha and Darren.
Right. Did you feel like you were living in a fantasy world to be getting the calls from these people?
Well, it was not just a fantasy world. It was surreal because so much of the show had, you know, Darren calling home and saying, Sam, what's going on?
Yeah.
On the phone. And here I am right in an episode, a surreal episode of Bewitched. It was freaky. And then David White would not talk to me. And I finally had to call Elizabeth and asked her if, you know, she would call him and, you know, to okay an interview. And one day I met with her four times over her house. And one day I met with, on like the second or third meeting, I met with her. And she said, Herbie, I'm expecting a messenger at 4 o'clock. If you would please excuse me while this messenger comes and I do what I have to do. I said, no problem. Well, 4 o'clock, sure enough, came along and boom. In walks David White.
Oh, wow.
She had set up this meeting with him, you know, to shock me. And my mouth, of course, dropped. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm sitting in, you know, Elizabeth Montgomery's patio with Samantha and Larry. You know, and he walked in, and she walked away and got us some grapefruit juice. And he turns to me and says, beautiful house, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, I'm still in shock, you know. And I go, yeah, beautiful. And he goes, haven't been here in 15 years. So, you know, I brought these people together for whatever reason, you know, and I'm not saying that this is the best book in the world and this was the best thing in the world, but for those who love Bewitched, I wanted to make it a happy read. I wanted the people to read the book to be as happy as they were watching the show, and that's exactly why I did it. Nobody handed me $1 million. Nobody handed me a $100,000 contract to do the book. I did the book, you know, out of complete love for that show, and I believe that I was the one supposed to do it. And Elizabeth sensed that, and everybody eventually sensed that. The show speaks to so many people. It spoke to me as a kid, of course. You know, obviously it said something to me. I was picked on as a child because I was so cute.
Yeah.
And everybody beat me up. And I identified with Samantha's sense of isolation, and a lot of people did, you know, a lot of minorities in the 60s, a lot of people who were looking for peace beyond, you know, the riot, race rioting, Vietnam, all that stuff. I mean, Elizabeth would get calls from people saying, lady, if you're really a magic lady, could you please stop the war?
Yeah.
It's heavy, you know, And I don't think that Elizabeth really knew how loved she truly was until I reintroduced her to this, because she had moved on from Bewitched.
Of course.
And one of the reasons why she didn't want to talk about it is because she felt nobody cared. And I'm like, you know, that's not true. Everybody loves you, you know?
Well, you know, you can understand her perspective, though, too, because she was such a phenomenal actress, and she couldn't be Samantha for her whole career.
No.
I mean, she just couldn't. But at the same time, Samantha was a big part of her career, and it's, you know, it's what most everybody remembers her as.
Yeah.
And when I read her interview with The Advocate, I was touched because she mentioned that even during the filming of Bewitched, it had been discussed about what a metaphor it was for gay people, how they had to hide who they really were.
Correct.
had to put up a front, had to pretend to be something they weren't because people wouldn't understand them.
That's right.
And I think that's why, you know, there is a huge gay following for the show. That, and of course, because of, you know, many of the cast members also, you know, Paul Lynde and Agnes Moorehead and some others being open, well, sort of openly gay, as openly gay as you could be back then. But it's just a phenomenal show, and it touches a lot of people's hearts, even today.
Da-da. Yeah. You know what I love about the show is the music, because whenever, like, Serena would come on, mm-hmm. you know, they'd have the...
That slink.
Da-na-na-na-na-na, the seducing Serena theme. And she loved doing that. She loved
Serena. Serena was wonderful. Yeah, and she was two totally different people.
That's right.
And, you know, I think it's amazing, because when they listed Serena, of course, the actress playing her as Pandora Spock...
Right.
People really believed there was this other person.
Well, I did. I didn't know it was somebody else, so I got old, you know.
Uh-huh.
And she used to fool people on the set. The Jerry Davis, who would later on go to produce The Odd Couple, he was a producer and a director on the show in the beginning. You know, one day, the first day that she was on the set with that black wig, he didn't know who the heck it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he went up to her and he started saying to himself, you know, how am I going to get this brunette to go to dinner with me? And, you know, Elizabeth played along. She
of
was
course.
Like, and then finally she said, look, Jerry, it's me, Liz. So she fooled people on the set.
Let's hear some Agnes Moorehead stories.
Well, Agnes really didn't want to do Bewitched as a series. She had known Harry Ackerman, the executive producer of the show, and he had asked her to do the show. And on the fly, she just said, yeah, okay, it'll probably never sell. I'll do the pilot, you know, and then I can just go on and do what I want to do. And then Elizabeth had asked her as well in Macy's or something in some big New York department store. And she said, okay, maybe I'll do it, maybe not. Anyway, she ended up doing the pilot. Huge hit, of course. And she really, really resented that the show sold. But after a time, I really think that she enjoyed sitting there on the mantelpiece in those chiffon gowns and doing all those wonderful scenes. And later on, certainly, she did. And, you know... It was a special time for TV. It was a special time.
Well, what do people need to do to order Bewitched Forever?
Well, you could either go to Amazon.com
mm-hmm.
or BarnesandNoble.com, or you could order directly from the publisher at info@summitbooks.com.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. I had a great time. Your book is absolutely wonderful, and I appreciate you writing it.
Thank you so much for those wonderful, kind words.
That was Herbie J. Pilato, the author of Bewitched Forever, chatting with This Way Out correspondent Joan Devlin. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambage, Rex Walkner, John Frame, and Joan Devlin contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Arcus Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WMPG Gorham, Maine, CFRU Guelph, Ontario, KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody, stay tuned.